Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. Every state has its own college savings plan, but they're not created equal. Is it as easy as a few mouse clicks to find a good one?
No, to be perfectly honest with you, because it's somewhat of a shell game.
Decoding 529 education accounts. And in this strange new economic reality, you might find yourself saying things you never thought possible, even to your landlord.
I'd like you to work with me in dropping the price. The landlord is thinking, are you nuts?
No, you're not. We'll teach you how and when to negotiate on rent. Plus, what does a five-year-old understand about being a socialist?
Things are really bad right now. It's the capitalists' fault. As soon as the workers rise up, things are going to be great.
We talk with the author of a book about growing up with and against American consumer culture. That and more coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. It's that time of year when college seniors hold their collective breath. They're waiting for fat or thin envelopes to arrive in the mail. Or maybe these days they're just waiting for an announcement on Facebook. But you can be sure that the next piece of mail won't be something to look forward to. The college bill. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers.
Planning for college just got more and less expensive. This week, the nation's largest private student loan lender, Sallie Mae, changed the rules on when you've got to start paying those loans back. The move comes as the Obama administration has proposed cutting government subsidies to all private student lenders. Mark Kantrowitz is the publisher of the financial aid news site FinAid.org. And let's start with a very basic explanation of these changes.
The two main differences between this new loan and existing private student loans. First of all, borrowers are required to pay the interest during the in-school period instead of deferring that interest and capitalizing at repayment. And second, it cuts the loan term in half. For example, a typical private student loan might have a 15 to 30-year term. This new loan has a 5 to 15-year repayment term.
It certainly sounds like a good deal, but I have to say, it sounds to me like this is a step toward the death of private loans, because really, what student has the money to start paying while they're in school?
Certainly, some students won't be able to afford this loan, but given that the lender is being selective anyway, at least this selectivity is headed in a more constructive direction. With regard to being able to pay the interest during the in-school period, it's going to start off lower because your loan balance as a freshman is lower than your loan balance as a senior. The amount of interest that the typical student might have to pay as a freshman was $50, $60 a month. That's the cost of a few DVDs, eating out a few times. It's well within the disposable income of many students. And if they do have problems, they can always have a parent or other cosigner pay the interest for them.
Who might this loan be good for?
This certainly is going to be good for students who need to get money that have exhausted the federal loan limits. This provides them with an attractive option.
How does this fit in terms of the tax deduction that you can get for student loans?
There's a student loan interest tax deduction of up to $2,500 in student loan interest per year. Since the students would be paying interest during the in-school period, they would be eligible for that income tax deduction.
Do you think that this change could affect the choice of college for some students?
If students are overborrowing and they find that credit is less available, they can't afford the school that you're in, then you should certainly consider a lower cost public college or other less expensive institution. That isn't necessarily a bad thing.
Mark Kantrowitz is the publisher of FinAid.org. We'll have a link to that on our website. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Changes to student loans aren't the only issue facing incoming college students. Those with money set aside in a state-sponsored education plan have watched their returns wither almost as fast as 401ks. They're called 529s and are offered by all 50 states. The College Savings Foundation says assets in those plans dropped 21% in the fourth quarter of last year. That's causing a whole new round of scrutiny for a savings program that's gotten mad props since its debut in 1997. Bill Parrish is a financial planner based in Portland, Oregon. And Bill, your initial opinion here?
It's a terrific program. What's unique, though, is every state has a different program. So it can be confusing because when this law was set up, there was no SEC oversight provided. So basically, the oversight falls to individual states, and then it becomes a political process. There's a bidding process in each state.
A bidding process for which mutual fund plan, say, you're going to hire?
Right. So for instance, in Oregon, Vanguard might be competing with Oppenheimer. And then whoever's in charge in the state chooses the vendor, basically.
But how are you supposed to sift through the various states and their plans? Is there anything that helps you with comparing and contrasting?
No, to be perfectly honest with you, because it's somewhat of a shell game. For instance, here in Oregon, we have a Oppenheimer and they give it a certain name. But in Illinois, it's the same plan, but with a different name. It basically needs regulatory oversight by the Securities and Exchange Commission. And the most simple thing would be to just accurately communicate the returns. But, you know, the good news is there are 50 plans out there. You know, what I'd say to any person out there concerned about the college savings plan, two great choices. Go to Vanguard.com and choose Vanguard, or go to TD Ameritrade. They're both terrific choices. Forget your own state.
Okay, and we should make a note that you are not in any way paid by them.
No, I've never accepted a penny from any investment company. I'm an SEC registered investment advisor, and I will definitively say that the two best are Vanguard and TD Ameritrade.
Let me ask you about two other factors that are involved in the 529 plan that I think make it also confusing for people. One of which is that in many or perhaps all of them, there are real restrictions on when you can go in and make adjustments to the plan. And then second of all, there are tax considerations in some of these states, correct?
Yes. The restrictions, basically, you can move your account just like you move an IRA up to one time a year. In terms of the actual investment choices, the mix, you can change that once a year also. And frankly, I think once a year should be fine. The second part of your question, the tax thing is completely overblown. For instance, here in Oregon, you get a tax deduction for state purposes only up to $2,000.
If you're in the Oregon plan.
Right, if you're in the Oregon plan. And most states are this way, okay? So if you're in the maximum tax bracket, it's a benefit to you of $180. But ask yourself, is it really worth taking that benefit of $180 and getting stuck with a bad Oregon plan? If I could give one common sense recommendation, I'd just say forget about the tax deduction altogether. Just go for a high-quality plan.
And I wanted to ask you one final question about kind of the behavior of 529 investors. It does seem that, at least from, you know, the folks who have written into the program, you know, they talk about how they really felt that they had to take a lot of risk and really be very aggressive in their investments. Because if you look down the line, you know, 20 years from now, you may be looking at a college education bill of $100,000, $200,000. And there's no way you're going to get there unless you take a lot of risk. And I think that's where some folks have run into trouble in this market. Any advice for them?
What I would say to all those folks is, you know, it's important to save. And you get earnings from your investment, that's true. But I think the beautiful word they're missing is balance. Why not have 60% of the assets in high-quality fixed income and 40% in equities? The reason people are out of balance, the real inside story, is that the investment industry makes about three times in general in fees on anything you're in that's stock-based versus fixed income.
So the mantra, just like every other investment vehicle, is diversification.
Right. Investment's a beautiful thing. I mean, you got to do something. Imagine contributing 20 years to one of these plans and your kid doesn't go to college. They've got a great start in life. They get all those assets. Now, they'll be taxed at their tax bracket. But during that entire 20 years, all the income you earn from the fixed income, maybe some equity gains, it's all tax deferred. It's a terrific vehicle.
Bill Parrish is a financial planner based in Portland, Oregon. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com/new offers. and by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It's time for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And with me, with just a few opinions, is our good friend and economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tess. Just one or two.
Just one or two, yes. I wanted to get your take on something that was a topic of quite a bit of discussion here at Marketplace this week, which is how do you sort through the extremes that are being put forth by this and that economist? You know, we are either going to heck in a handbasket or we've hit bottom and everything's going to be okay.
Right. The rosy scenario. Do you have whiplash?
I have total whiplash. What am I supposed to think at this point?
You know, Tess, this is where I come back to my old mantra, the old rules. This is why I believe in diversification. Mm. Because, you know, sometimes I get really convinced by the negative story. And look at what we've lived through. What, a 50, 55% decline in the market? GM's under $2 a share. I mean, we're talking about the blue chip penny stocks.
Right. But then at the same time, this past Monday, the market sees a 500-point rally.
Exactly. And, you know, I'm in the camp that's been talking on the air and blogging and saying, I think if you take everything together, you look at the fiscal stimulus, the homeowners plan, the bank bailout, you take it all together, don't look too closely, I think we are at the turning point. But how do you invest your money? And this is where I come back to the old lesson, August 1979.
1979. Oh, we are in the Wayback Machine.
A little Nehru jacket. I look good in a Nehru jacket. You know, I had a Nehru jacket at one point.
Chris, I want a photo of that for the website, okay?
You don't want even you don't want a picture, trust me. All right, we're back August 1979, Business Week cover, the death of equities.
The death of equities. Yeah, so much for that.
This has become the famous example of contrarians. You know, see, when everyone gets really negative, that's when you want to buy. And it was written in August 1979. The market bottomed out in August 1982.
So basically for 3 years the cover was accurate.
Yes, for 3 more years. So if you're right where we are now, what, March 2009. So what's that? March 2012? That's
Yikes.
When the bottom's going to come.
We have that much pain? I hope not. So back in 1979, when there was this Business Week cover, you know, that said the death of equities, was there also at that time the opposite extreme in terms of people saying, no, buy more, buy more?
Oh, absolutely. Because they're always, it's Wall Street.
Because that's exactly what we're seeing now.
That's what we're seeing now. And that's what Wall Street does. Ronald Reagan came in. It was morning in America after the election. So there's a lot of optimism. And nevertheless, it wasn't a great period of time for our economy. So there always is this whiplash. And, you know, you can lean a little bit in one direction, lean a little bit in the other direction. But this is why I just come back down to the fundamentals. Diversify. And secondly, you have to look at your own life. Are your kids going to college next year? Just like you were talking about earlier, well, you don't want to put all their college money into the market because you have to write a check next year, right?
Right.
So follow the news, but stay diversified.
Sounds good to me.
Sounds good to me, too. Thanks a lot, Des.
Thanks, Chris. Some companies say they can erase scratches, dings, even minor dents in your credit score. Well, that would take a credit miracle. And truth be told, these guys are no angels.
Those can't happen. It just cannot happen.
Plus, feel like you're paying too much rent in this down market? Everyone's negotiating these days, even landlords. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Last week, we told you about all the scams proliferating online, on TV, and everywhere else, promising to, say, lower your property tax bill or help you avoid foreclosure. This week, the companies that claim they can clean up your credit. Sally Herships finds out why people are believing what they hear in those ubiquitous ads and what they end up getting.
Beverly White is 58. She's divorced, lives in Charlotte. She's a behavioral specialist with teen girls. She was renting a townhouse, but wanted to buy a house.
My goal was to own a home, something I could show I had accomplished in my years of living.
But her credit rating was way too low to qualify for a mortgage. She had unpaid medical bills and other debt. Her FICO score was somewhere in the 400 to 500 range, or about 200 points less than what she needed. Then her real estate agent said he knew someone who could help. This guy could clean up Beverly's credit history. That was around August.
He guaranteed that by December, my credit would be cleared and things would be okay, and I would be able to then apply for my home.
You know where this is going, right? December rolls around and Beverly's credit report, untouched. And the guy she paid $1,400 to up front isn't returning her calls. She's been scammed. The Federal Trade Commission says complaints about credit repair scams went up 50% last year. Tom Bartholomew is president of the Better Business Bureau in Charlotte. He says asking for money in advance of service is one way to recognize a scam. It's illegal.
They make these promises, they make these guarantees, and that's what entices people to come across with the upfront fee.
But Bartholomew says scammers make claims people cannot resist.
If you have a foreclosure on your credit history, they'll get that erased. If you have a bankruptcy on your history, if you have repossessions on your credit history, they'll have that erased. Those can't happen. It just cannot happen.
No matter how bad, how late, how scary items on your credit history may seem, if they're correct, Bartholomew says there's no way to erase them. Bad debts have to cycle off, and that takes time, up to 7 years. And scammers know people don't want to wait.
Are you trying to buy a home? Is your credit causing your loan to be a problem? Stop being discriminated against because of your credit score. Credit Repair Services offers the removal of tax liens, bankruptcies, student loans, and other collections.
That's a commercial for one of the many services that says they can remove negative items from credit reports. I wanted to find out how they'd explain this. Remember, unless there's a mistake, negative items can't be removed from credit reports. So I called one of the companies, Today's Credit Solutions. I asked John Pausch, a manager there, about a claim on their website, a guarantee to improve scores.
That's something that you can guarantee for every customer?
Oh, yeah. You know, for us, the more negative items that are on there, the more we're going to remove.
Pausch says they're able to raise their customers' credit scores by an average of 100 points.
Let's say that I really didn't pay a bill. How can you get that taken off my credit history?
Just leveraging the laws to do it.
Pausch says his credit repair firm is a member of the Better Business Bureau, but the BBB says they've revoked the company's accreditation. But while almost everything these services claim isn't doable, they are right about one thing. It is possible to clean up a credit score. Beverly White again.
The sad news, I could have done it myself from the beginning. Hindsight is always 20/20.
Tom Bartholomew at the Better Business Bureau says if there really is a mistake, an error on your credit history, you can contact the reporting agency to get it corrected. You're also entitled, by law, to one free copy of your credit report every year. And he says, if you've had bad credit, you have to do what the lenders are looking for. Show you can make regular payments.
I was really looking for a quick fix. That's what the bottom line actually is, a quick fix.
Beverly White wasn't able to get a penny back from the scammer, but she says she did get her credit cleaned up herself. She slowly rebuilt her score with new cards and quick payoffs. Now she says her rating is over 700, high enough to get a mortgage. She was finally able to buy a home in Charlotte, her first. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers. And by Constant Contact, helping more than 250,000 small businesses and nonprofits succeed using email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Constant Contact, a smart way to reach your customers. Marketplace Money is supported by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant making and educational funding. Online at FINRAFoundation.org.
Check the Craigslist apartment ads lately? Well, in hot spots like San Francisco and New York, you probably won't see much change. But in lots of other places, rent is down. Janet Portman is an attorney who's written guides for landlords, and she talked to us about the best ways to negotiate rent.
When you're renting an apartment or a home, it's not the same thing as, for instance, buying a car. You can go to the Toyota dealer and pretty much insist that that dealer drop his price. Let's face it, you're not going to have to deal with that guy in the future. That's not the case with your landlord. And I think it's important to step back further and think to yourself, well, what happens in a tight market? The landlord's got 17 applicants lined up. He raises the rent simply because he can. He's taking advantage. We call landlords like that greedy and gouging landlords. Well, the tables are turned in a soft market. If you say to the landlord, I know it's market rent, but I'm going to press you to drop it further. It's not a good way to start off your relationship because, unlike the car dealer, you're going to have a lot to do with this landlord in the future.
So you don't want to be the greedy, gouging tenant.
Right. You don't say, I want you to drop the price because you're desperate. What you do say is, I'm going to give you something in return that's going to make it worthwhile. Namely, I am a trouble-free tenant who's going to pay the rent on time, not damage the property, not hassle the neighbors, stay there for a long time, or at least the length of your lease. That is the tit-for-tat that you're setting up with the landlord.
What if you have already proven that you're a great tenant? You're in an apartment and you're seeing that rents are dropping in your neighborhood in similar units. You decide that you really don't want to move, but you'd like to see a similar price.
There's no law against going back to the landlord and saying, look, here's the situation. The value of this apartment has dropped, say, by $100. If we look at the comparables, if we look at what you're renting in this building now, they're going for less. I'd like you to work with me in dropping the price. The landlord is thinking, are you nuts? But if he thinks a little further, he's going to be re-renting for that low rent that he has refused to offer to you. And that makes no sense.
So you're really appealing to the hopefully rational side of your landlord.
Well, you know, most landlords who are professionals, they understand this. They know that the industry standard is 2 months of vacancy at turnover time. And they know that the value of a good tenant who doesn't cause hassles is more valuable than an extra couple of $100s per month.
Janet, are there any situations that renters should be wary of in this kind of market?
A lot of properties are on the market, particularly single-family homes, that are now looking rather attractive to investors who, for obvious reasons, are not that attracted to putting money in the stock market. That person is really not a professional landlord, is not someone who basically knows what they're doing. And for the tenant, that spells headaches. The first thing you'd want to know is, what's the history of this house? Did it have vandals? While they sat vacant, the banks held them but did nothing to keep them up. Cosmetic fixes can hide problems that perhaps have not been adequately addressed by the new landlord.
Janet Portman is an attorney and the author most recently of Every Landlord's Legal Guide. Thanks so much for your help today.
You're very welcome.
525,600. It's time for Getting Personal when we answer your money questions. And with me once again is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hello again, Chris.
Hello again, Tess. That's good to be with you, though.
Excellent, excellent. Well, our first call is from Joshua in Mechanicsville, New York. Hello, Joshua.
Hi.
I understand you have a question about your 401k.
Absolutely.
All right. Hit us.
My wife and I are actually debating whether or not to stop contributing to our 401k to get into a house this year because of the stimulus package. Her company matches 6% of her income, so it's kind of a great debate whether we should sacrifice for the short-term or long-term.
Yeah, Chris, I'm sure this is a debate that's going on not just at Josh's house. You know, folks trying to figure out whether in this kind of market it's wise to save that money in a different way than putting it aside for retirement.
Right, and there are no absolutes here. But in general, my bias is That 6%, that's the real key behind a 401k, a 403b, one of these retirement savings plans. So if you stop contributing to the 401k and you're no longer taking the match, it's not just that you're reducing your savings over time, your household is taking a pay cut. And I have a big question about that. Now, cutting down to the match can make a lot of sense for households needing to free up cash for an alternative use, whether that's to build up emergency savings or, as in your case, Joshua, you know, trying to invest in a home. But I would really still lean toward that, keeping that 6% match and be incredibly reluctant to let it go.
Okay, great. That's I appreciate it.
So is that something that that you could do, take your contributions down to the match?
Actually, it is at the match right now.
It's at the match, okay.
We could find different ways to make it work.
So where are you thinking about buying a house?
In upstate New York, around the Clifton Park area.
Yeah, how's the market up there?
It's still actually pretty high. It hasn't come down as much as we'd like it to.
But you'd like to take advantage of that $8,000 tax credit?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's certainly another factor in making that decision.
Yeah.
Well, good luck.
All right. I appreciate it.
All right, Chris, we have another question about retirement plans, and Scott writes in from Sumter, South Carolina. He knows that generally it is a bad idea to take a loan from a 401k plan, but he's wondering if it's ever considered more acceptable to do this to wipe out credit card debt. So you borrow from your 401k plan and pay off these credit cards, then, of course, owing yourself back what you took out of your 401k. Is there any time where this is a good idea, Chris?
In very rare circumstances, it can be the right thing to do.
Hmm.
We're talking about foreclosure, enormous credit card bills that's going to drive you into bankruptcy. In those circumstances, you take extreme measures, but 98% of the time, I'd say no. And in the economy that they're in right now, boy, you really have to understand the risk. Remember, if you borrow from your 401k and you lose your job,
you got to pay it all back.
You're absolutely right, Tess. You got to pay it all back. And if you don't pay it all back, you are paying the 10% penalty plus state and federal income tax. So as a general rule of thumb, a third of the money has disappeared.
Okay, so there you go, Scott. A few things for you to consider before you make this move. And let's go to another email. Jackie writes in from Cincinnati, Ohio. She's wondering when she's going to start to see some of this economic stimulus money in her paycheck. Wondering when that's going to start.
Sure. Many people are already seeing it, and the law requires your employer to have made the change by the beginning of April.
Okay. And the second question, she says some of her coworkers are saying that they will be taxed on that increase if they accept it in their paychecks. What do you know about this?
In general, the answer is no. You will not be taxed on this.
Okay.
Now, remember, all your employer is doing is going through the tax tables and lowering your withholding, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're not calling you up and saying, how much does your husband or your wife make?
Right.
So you could end up as a two-income couple in a circumstance where too much money is going into your pocket. And under those circumstances, there might be a slight liability. Because you can make an adjustment yourself, by the way. Most employers will allow you to make changes in your withholding.
Chris, what if you are single but you have two jobs?
Yes, if you have two jobs and you're making a pretty decent income and both your employers make the adjustment, because remember, your employer's not saying, what are you making in that other job?
Right.
You could end up in that circumstance. You could also, if they're alimony payments, you do need to be aware of what's going on. In general, I think most people are going to be okay, but tick through the different circumstances and see how you're doing.
All right. Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And we are answering your questions every weekday online at marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link there. And stay tuned for more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. A little bit ago, we talked about negotiating your rent, but there are things that you cannot haggle over, namely airline fees. This week, U.S. Airways President Scott Kirby said that fees for things like checked luggage, meals, even those postcard-sized pillows, they are here to stay, even for frequent flyers. But on this week's A Day in the Work Life, we'll meet another kind of frequent flyer who's not too concerned about those a la carte comforts.
Mothers should always caution their sons about making a career choice that requires a crash helmet.
My name is Ray Dyson. I'm 58 years old, and I'm a pilot for Southeastern Aerial Crop Service in Fort Pierce, Florida. Many people refer to it as crop dusting. Nowadays, we refer to ourselves as aerial applicators. I've been doing this since 1973. I had a childhood passion for flight, so I started flying as soon as I could get a driver's license and drive to the airport. Here at Southeastern, we fly air tractor aircraft. It's a large single-engine turboprop airplane. It has about a 50-foot wingspan, about 800 horsepower. Most mornings around here, like this morning, was pretty typical, where I started at daylight and I covered about 720 acres. And on a good day, I can cover anywhere from 500 to 1,000 acres. Most of our application is for spraying and that sort of thing is done at an altitude of between 7 and 10 feet above the crop, and we're generally going about 140 to 150 miles an hour. A good ag pilot in today's world can expect to make up to $100,000 a year or more. The industry's changed a lot in the last 25 or 30 years. When I started in this business, I was flying converted World War II trainers, Stearman biplanes, and operators had bought these things surplus after the war and didn't have a whole lot invested in them. And basically, if you were crazy enough to fly it, they were willing to hire you and let you do it. Nowadays, things have to be a whole lot more sane than that. These airplanes cost close to $1 million a copy, so they're very, very strict about the kind of pilots that they put in the airplanes. Primary hazards that we have to look out for is wires. There's naturally barns and structures like that. And one big problem that's developed over the last number of years is cell phone towers. They're going up everywhere. So we got to watch out for those, because sometimes they'll just seem to spring up overnight. When you're doing well at this, it becomes like a Zen-like meditation. There's no more acute sense of living in the moment is when you're flying a 800 horsepower ag airplane 150 miles an hour and being totally focused on what you're doing, and everything else is outside.
That was aerial applicator Ray Dyson. If you'd like to see pictures of Ray dusting crops, check out our website, marketplace.org. A Day in the Work Life was reported by Wally Nichols. Tax time isn't pleasant for any of us, but for gay couples, it can be an even bigger mess than usual.
For that key piece of information of how to combine two forms, I couldn't find the answer anywhere.
Taxes and domestic partnership, coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Tax season means giant headaches for pretty much all of us. But in states where same-sex partners are allowed to file joint tax returns, they still have to file federally as individuals. And for gay couples, that means complicated paperwork and added expense. Reporter Mina Kim visited a San Francisco couple caught in the tax tangle.
Linda Susan Ulrich and her wife Emily Drennan have been happily married for 6 years. At their cottage home in San Francisco, they show me wedding photos and reminisce.
We were getting our picture taken like there was no tomorrow. And
we got married on a Friday the 13th, right?
Oh, yeah, actually. It was February 13th.
Ulrich and Drennan met years ago, but in the eyes of the federal government, they're strangers. Although California allows same-sex couples to file joint tax returns, the federal government doesn't recognize gay marriages. Under the Defense of Marriage Act, it won't recognize civil unions or registered domestic partnerships either. That means same-sex couples have to file separate returns to the IRS as if they're single.
It was rather a nightmare and took a while to put all the pieces in place.
Ulrich had to figure out how to split up shared accounts to create their individual returns. She also had to split their expenses, like mortgage and insurance. But the hardest part was trying to recombine those figures to do their joint state taxes. Their deductions as individuals didn't jive with their deductions as a married couple.
for that key piece of information of how to combine two forms, I couldn't find the answer anywhere.
San Francisco CPA Chris Kalaya says that's because the rules are still unclear.
I highly recommend that people maintain separate bank accounts, that they pay their deductions in the way they would prefer to deduct them, that they avoid commingling when they can.
But even with careful tax planning, it's typical for same-sex couples to end up paying more to file their taxes. Since state forms require data from federal forms, same-sex couples have to first prepare a fake or dummy joint federal return. Online programs like TurboTax and TaxCut charge extra for that dummy return. And if there are any complications along the way, often the online programs can't handle the filings. Kalaya says that means going to a CPA like him.
We're finding that the cost of preparing the return is considerable because we're preparing the returns three times as opposed to twice.
But for Ulrich, the biggest cost is an emotional one. She says it hurts that she and her wife Drennan can't file their taxes the same way straight couples can.
In all of those hours that I'm spending on the taxes, I'm constantly reminded that I'm a second-class citizen. I'm less than.
Ulrich has yet to tackle her taxes this year. But to help her cope, she says Drennan bought her a do-it-yourself tax kit she happened to find online.
With a combination of, like, tax preparation and a box of tissues and a bottle of Jack Daniels.
Ulrich says she probably won't use the certificate for tax preparation included in the kit because their situation is so complex. But taking a shot of Jack? That, she says, is a lot more likely. In San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers. And by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. Marketplace Money is supported by SaveAndInvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at SaveAndInvest.org.
We are back with more Getting Personal, and Chris Lola is on the phone from Minneapolis, Minnesota, your neck of the woods. Hello, Lola.
Hi.
How are you today?
I'm excellent. How are you?
Doing all right. I was about to sing the song, of course, and then I thought better of it.
Yes.
I'm sure it would have been the very first time you've ever gotten that before.
Yeah, I have no idea what you're talking about.
All right. Well, setting that aside, what's your question for Chris today?
Well, my question has to do with buying life insurance. My husband and I are both attorneys and in the process of putting aside some money to buy our first house. We don't have any kids, but it's definitely on the horizon. We're hoping to start a family within the next year. And we recently actually switched financial planners, moving right along with a new person, and then they brought up the issue of life insurance. And I've always been somewhat skeptical because I know that's how a lot of financial planners make a lot of money. Well, she ended up suggesting that we consider a policy of like $3 million per person. Through the entire time, I kept asking, well, how much is this going to cost? And not really getting an answer. At the end of the meeting, you know, she's about to have us sign the application, and I see written down somewhere is like $314.00. And I was like, what's that? And she's like, that's how much it's going to cost every month. Whoa.
Wow. Chris, first of all, red flag on any financial advisor who's not being upfront with costs.
Right.
Absolutely. Most of the financial advisors I know, I mean, that is, they lay it out, and you can like it or not like it, but it's, you know, it's there for you to see. So we have warning bells going off there.
Yeah.
There's a couple ways to think about life insurance for couples without children is, you know, to think through, okay, so what if, you know, tragedy, one of you died? How about setting it up for a year so that the surviving spouse doesn't have to worry about a bill, a mortgage, nothing for a year? So it's having those kinds of discussions before you set up a sum like $3 million, which is awfully large.
Yeah.
I'd sort of start it a different way. The life that you live now and the life that you'd like your partner to have if you were to pass away,
mm-hmm.
it's that kind of a discussion that I'd be having.
Okay.
Yeah, and Chris, I mean, the fact that the financial advisor didn't have that discussion and just kind of pulled out this figure.
Yeah, I mean, she said that. She did say, you know, you both have to think about how much you need for the other person to be happy. But that said, the jumping off point was $3 million.
Each. So that's $6 million worth of life insurance.
And, you know, I'm guessing, you know, if you're a couple with two kids, sort of standard starting place is 6 to 8 times income. And that's with kids.
Okay. 6 times our joint income is not $3 million. It's certainly not $6 million. But what does that mean for us going forward with this planner? You know, like I said, we just started working with this person.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's a real warning bell. And, boy, I had to dress it up front with her.
Okay. This is super helpful. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Well, Chris, we have another question about life insurance, and Susan wrote in from Baltimore, Maryland. She's the beneficiary of a life insurance policy that's been taken out by her parents. Thankfully, they are still alive, but her question is about the stability of the policy itself. With all the news that we're hearing about, for example, AIG, the insurance company, other insurance companies that are facing similar issues, what kind of protections do beneficiaries have for various scenarios that include, you know, a life insurance company going bankrupt? Are there protections similar to, say, the FDIC for bank accounts, SIPC for investment accounts, anything like that?
Well, there are no absolute guarantees in the world of insurance, life insurance, but there are layers of protection. First of all, let's take AIG. Let's make it a concrete example. Now, AIG has life insurance companies. It has retirement asset management companies. And they are separate from the parent company. So the parent company can get in trouble, and the life insurance company can be okay.
Okay.
Your next layer of protection is that, by law, life insurance companies need to invest their assets conservatively. Now, there's always violations of that, as you can imagine. There's a history of companies pushing the rules. But as a general rule of thumb, they do invest their assets conservatively. And this is where, despite all the holes and all the, you know, the questions we have, I do think that it does pay still to look at how the rating agencies judge the company and whether it is considered a blue-chip life insurance company or not.
What about governmental protection?
We have two. State regulators come in because life insurance regulated by the states.
Okay.
Here's the good news. The state-led regulator by law runs the company in the benefit of the policyholder. The creditors, the bondholders, everybody else, back of the line. The fourth one is state guarantee funds. And this kind of gets to your question about, is there a SIPC or an FDIC?
Mm-hmm.
It's not the same thing. It's industry supported. What they do is they also come in and they help support the policyholders of the life insurance company that is in trouble. So if you're with a good life insurance company, you should be okay.
All right. Well, unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show, but Chris is now answering your personal finance questions online every weekday. Just visit our website. It's marketplace.org and click on the Getting Personal link. You can also call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, thanks, as always, for the terrific advice.
Tess, you're welcome.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. In this economy, many children are going without the things they want. But if you grow up as a devout socialist, going without is a way of life beyond a recession. Saeed Seyrafizadeh writes about being raised by his single mom in the Socialist Workers' Party. His memoir is When Skateboards Will Be Free. The title comes from the first chapter.
On one occasion, I mustered the courage to ask my mother to buy me a skateboard. They were all the rage at the time. And after much inveigling, she finally agreed to have a look. There in the middle of the sports department sat a giant metal bin filled with skateboards in bubblegum bright colors and a sign that read, $10.99. I want the green one, I said. Once the revolution comes, my mother said, everyone will have a skateboard because all skateboards will be free. Then she took me by the hand and led me out of the store.
Saeed Seyrafizadeh reading from his book When Skateboards Will Be Free. I asked if he understood the ideas behind those politics as a child.
I believe I did. And I think I believed them, too. You know, I have certain moments where I describe like going to party meetings. You know, I was 5 or 6 having absolutely no idea what was being talked about. But I got the essence. And the essence was things are really bad right now. It's the capitalists' fault. As soon as the workers rise up, things are going to be great. Essentially, most of my mother's energy and time went into helping to bring this to fruition. And our own personal passions and desires put on hold.
A lot of stories about growing up poor are, you know, about overcoming struggle. They paint poverty as something that taught them important lessons, gave them strength. You say a few times in the book that the poverty was self-inflicted
right.
by your
right.
parents. Does that make the experience different?
You know, since it's my experience, I think I have a hard time. I'd have a hard time comparing it to somebody else who just grew up poor and they had absolutely no options. You know, I didn't realize it so much as a child. It wasn't until as an adult looking back that I saw that my mother, who came from a middle class background, she went to college at a time when it was not necessarily common for women to go to college. She had options. But part of the sort of psychology of the Socialist Workers' Party is that you should not strive to be a success in this society. That if you somehow do manage success and achievement, you have only come about that through exploitation. So there was a real just like we should have no aspirations. We should have very few sort of material things. Whether that makes it worse than someone who grew up without options, I don't know. But I think it definitely adds an interesting psychological layer to it.
Speaking of psychology, when it comes to teaching kids about money, some of the basic rules, like
right.
don't steal, they weren't so basic
right.
for
oh,
you.
Yeah, right, sure.
I'm talking about the grapes here. Can you describe this story for us?
Sure. 1973, there was a grape boycott that was brought by the United Farm Workers that asked people not to eat grapes.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went without grapes. But I remember going for years, actually, without eating grapes. I complained about having grapes as a child. I threw temper tantrums about grapes.
It made you want them even more.
Yeah, there was something about the not having, and I wouldn't put it past my mother to have sort of encouraged that sort of desire and then held it back from me. But the story is finally in the supermarket one day, this is in Brooklyn, in front of a huge mound of grapes, she finally gave in and allowed me to eat the grapes in the store. The way that she got around, you know, that we're violating the boycott, but the boycott is saying, don't buy grapes. And since we're not buying them, what we're doing is we're stealing them, and in some way we're strengthening the struggle of the farm workers.
So, you know, the differences between what you learned and what other kids learned about money are really a big part of the book.
Yeah.
But as an adult, you seem to describe a pretty solid middle-class life. You know, what kind of process was involved in really choosing quite a different path from that of your mother?
Well, and this is going to sound ironic, but for many years I worked for Martha Stewart. She had a pretty big influence on me. You know, I don't know her personally, but I worked in the company. And I loved being around opulence. I really did. I loved the beautiful things she created. I loved the free pastries that were baked in the test kitchen and put out, you know, in the conference room. It was almost as if finally as an adult, I was allowing myself to have what I couldn't have as a child.
So skateboards are still not free, but pastries are at Martha Stewart.
That's right. That's right. Pastries are, and I talk about it in the book. I talk about being given like sample sheets
right.
from a photo shoot, and I remember distinctly like going home, putting the sheets on, and then going, "Huh, those look pretty good. Maybe I can get some pillowcases to go with them." And then it was sort of this entire transformation of, wow, it's nice to have nice things. And it's been cathartic. It's been extremely cathartic.
I think it's fascinating to think of how you made that shift.
It was, sure.
You know, was that a gradual thing? I mean, how you get to that point?
Yeah, you know, it's gradual. It's gradual. It's incremental. It's still inside of me, you know. I mean, even today, thinking about coming to do the interview, I was thinking, Maybe I shouldn't take the $2 subway to get to the studio. Maybe I should ride my bike and save $2. And those kinds of things are going through my mind. Happily, I'm able to give myself more now than take away from myself.
That's fascinating that this book then comes out in the middle of an historic economic crisis.
Right. Yeah.
I wonder if it makes you think that maybe your parents were right. Or that some people deserve to lose all this money. There's a lot of anger against the wealthy right now. That seems a little bit like what you grew up with.
Sure. Well, you know, not every single thing the Socialist Workers Party says is wrong. I think a critique of capitalism can be a good thing. What I should point out is that this economic crisis that is happening now was happening my entire childhood. I mean, we were always on the verge of the Great Depression and World War III. It was imminent.
Saeed Seyrafizadeh is the author of When Skateboards Will Be Free, out this week. Thanks so much for coming in. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, what happens when a family gets pink slipped?
I got to tell you, when it actually did happen, I mean, it was like, you know, sort of a blow. It's like, wow, we never thought both of us would be laid off.
Marketplace Money's producers include Stephen Hoffman and Eve Troe, with help this week from Doug Krisner. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something from Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers.
American Public Media.